see everybody back tonight. I assume some of our folks, I know some of them are away for traveling and so forth because of the holiday, but good to have everybody back. Let me get right into the lesson, and again, this is, I'm going to preach for about 15, maybe 18 minutes here, try to limit it to that, and then I'll open up for questions and discussion. Primarily, I'd like for you to be thinking about, and you might want to turn to Luke 19, but I'd like for you to be thinking about Zacchaeus and, Zacchaeus, and in particular, I want us to look at this idea of the repentance of Zacchaeus, and you may be thinking along these lines, but we're going to look at how he repented, what he actually did in particular, and if you want to ask some questions or make some comments or, have a discussion about, in particular, what he did, because there's a lot of question, I think, that surrounds that. Maybe think along those lines. Again, we'll respect the decorum of 1 Corinthians 14. Men, feel free to speak out. And the ladies, I'd like to ask you, and one lady has already done that, but to turn in a question on a card. And if you need a card, you can raise your hand, and Wes will be glad to bring you that. And Just raise your hand, Wes or I, one, we'll see, and he'll get a card to you. So be thinking along those lines. Let's get right into it. And, of course, in each of these, we're looking at the idea of being hopeless. And to be hopeless is, of course, to truly be without any expectation that things are going to be better, that things are going to get better, that they can be better. And when we're talking about spiritual matters, to be hopeless would be to be in a situation where you look at your current state of life and you say, there's no prospects for salvation, God wouldn't want me, that kind of thing. Now, in each of these cases, I chose someone that might parallel an individual today who might find themselves in such a situation, and they themselves or others might see them as hopeless. But the Bible certainly portrays them as not being so. Zacchaeus would be one of those people, and we'll talk about why that is the case. But he truly is not hopeless, and yet his situation might appear so. So in each one of these cases, I'm kind of asking, as we set up the story, what did he have going against him? As you look at this story, and all we really know about him from the Bible is in Luke 19 and the first 10 verses. To my knowledge, he's not mentioned anywhere else, even though he is outside the Bible in a number of traditions and historical records, etc. Might mention one or two of those. But anyway, in the Bible, this is what we know. I think the things that you notice immediately going against Zacchaeus is that, yet again, there is a story in the book of Luke of a tax collector. I want you to go back with me a couple of pages, and we're going to key off of last week's lesson. Look at Luke 15. Right through this area here, Jesus addresses, there are a number of situations that involve tax collectors. You may remember that the prodigal son was a parable, but it was a parable that was spoken. If you look at verses 1 and 2, there drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him. And there was also in Jesus' audience the Pharisees and scribes, and they were murmuring or grumbling or complaining, saying, this man receives sinners, and he even eats with them. Now you notice as you turn a page or so over, there's what Ed read for us, in which Jesus yet again talks about a parable, and in this particular case, he brings up a publican or a tax collector. And, of course, I won't reread this, but think about it. In Luke 15, there were actual publicans, tax collectors, sinners in the audience. One wonders, and I wonder, could Zacchaeus have been one of those people? Or if not, could Jesus have had him in mind when he said what he said in the parable he preached or told in Luke 18? The humility of a tax collector, which was foreign to those self-righteous Pharisees and scribes, and yet Zacchaeus obviously appears to have that kind of humility. Well, all of this kind of comes to a head in Luke 19 when the story of Zacchaeus is told here, and Zacchaeus certainly is a tax collector. It came to pass, verse 11, as he went to Jerusalem, he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee, and he entered into a certain village. Well, I'm in chapter 17. I ain't going to get it. Chapter 19. I knew something sounded wrong there. But he entered in verse 1 and passed through Jericho. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, which was the chief among the publicans, and he was rich. And so this brings us to the story of a real, live tax collector now. And in fact, in verse 2, he's chief among the publicans. And so what he's got going for him is that he's in this category of people. I called it on your outline his social position. And I'm just kind of generalizing. Because you know, once you begin to be with a group of people, associate with a group of people long enough, and you kind of become one of those people, that's a lot going against you if that group of people are not normally, generally inclined to be religious people. Moral people, church-going people, all of that kind of thing. So it sort of works against you. And Zacchaeus, that certainly would work against him. But I think another thing, and a great thing that is against him, quote-unquote, is his occupation. You'll notice how often in the gospel accounts that publicans or tax collectors, which might be considered normally a reputable occupation. Now, that's hard for me to get that out. No, I'm kidding. But it might be considered a reputable occupation, and yet you'll notice how the Bible couples them with sinners. And generally speaking, as I understand from history and those that know about such things, they say sinners were the lowest, the most, you know, the people, for example, the prostitutes would be in that category. And so tax collectors are grouped often together with these people. They were known, as I read about them, and really as you can see in the New Testament, they were known for kind of partying. And, you know, that was a great part of their pastime. I think we see that to a degree when Jesus calls Matthew. So all of that's going against him. But you'll notice also his wealth. Now, wealth doesn't have to go against you. But it oftentimes does. A lot of times when you study Zacchaeus, people will compare Zacchaeus, who appears to be willing, and we see in the story, willing to give away at least a great part of his wealth, and they compare him to the rich young ruler. If you go back to chapter 18, you see the rich young ruler down in verse 18 of that chapter, who was not willing to give away. And, you know, Jesus saying, go sell everything you got, give it to the poor, come and follow me. And he went away sorrowful because he had a whole lot. Well, Zacchaeus is rich. And the Bible, you know, clearly points that out. I think something else, too, that's interesting is his city. He's from Jericho. And Jesus talks about Jericho, passes through Jericho. We see that in Luke. Again, Luke stands out as the book, you know, that has this. But think of the parable of the Good Samaritan. Yes, there's the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. We often talk about that. And it's dangerous, and you know, the whole story of the Good Samaritan is someone gets beaten up and robbed and all of that. But think about also, in that story, a priest passed by on the other side, a Levite passed by on the other side. As I understand it, there was a great number of priests and Levites, quite a community of them, that lived in Jericho. And so, why am I bringing all that up? Well, look at Zacchaeus. You're in a less than reputable occupation. You're the chief, meaning you're the executive among the tax collectors. And you live in a community of very righteous, and if we listen to Jesus in Luke 18, very self-righteous, religious officials. And all that would go against you. You would be maybe the object of derision in the city of Jericho by so many that are righteous. Well, that kind of thing can really go against you. And I want to suggest a couple of other things, and you may notice on the outline, and you might find this strange that I would put these two things down there, but he was short. And James and I were kind of joking a little bit right before services, and, you know, we're talking about Zacchaeus. You remember the song, Short People Ain't Got Nobody? You remember? And the idea is when you have a physical handicap, that can go against you. You know, over time, because you are short or you're fat or whatever it might be, a number of comments can be made, sometimes even good-naturedly, etc., and it builds a resentment. It's just, it's kind of, there's a defensive posture. There's, in some respects, an inferiority complex that can grow out of that. And that might well be the case with someone that is so short of stature that the Bible, you think about it, the Bible doesn't often describe people for you, not very much. You don't know if they're tall or short or fat or skinny or dark-complected, light-complected, but it chooses to tell us of Zacchaeus. I think there's a reason for it, but he's short. And then to me, one of the most ironic things is that, do you know what Zacchaeus means? His parents chose to name him Zacchaeus, a name that means clean, pure, innocent in Hebrew. Now, how would you like to go through life with a stigma of being a tax collector and maybe all the attendant things that go with that occupation of cheating people out of their money, certainly of being considered a traitor because you collect taxes for the Romans? And your name means clean. Yeah, there goes Zacchaeus. Wow, yeah, some innocent guy that is. Some clean and pure guy he is. Wonder how many comments like that were made. I don't know if anybody in here knows what the word Michael means in Hebrew. Mikael means. But it's a question in Hebrew. And that question is, who is like God? I remember discovering that, and I can well remember exactly where I was the first time in a library when I read what my name meant. I was in the fifth grade, I was sitting in the library, and I'm Michael, who is like God. Now at that time, I thought that was pretty cool. But I made a lot of jokes over the next several years when people would start talking about their names and maybe what they meant and that kind of thing. I would say things like, yeah, Michael means who is like God. And then I'd say, I don't know, but it sure ain't me, that kind of thing. But you go through life with a name, and especially in this day, names really, they weren't chosen because you liked them. They were chosen for different reasons, but they meant something. His name means pure and innocent, and he's not been living that kind of life. So he's got a lot going against him if you stop to think about it. But I think importantly, he's got some things going for him. When you look at this story, that's what the story is about, what he's got going for him and what Jesus does to engage him. So let's quickly enumerate that, and then I'll open for any questions or discussions. But when you look at this story, the Bible tells us very quickly, and go with me to Luke 19. He was rich, he was a publican, all of that kind of thing. And then verse 3 stands out. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was. Or he was seeking to see who Jesus was. And he could not for the crowd or the press because he was little of stature. And he ran before and he climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him. For he was to pass that way. I want to suggest to you that in simple language, the attitude of Zacchaeus is what he really has going for him. Let's think about that for a moment. He was seeking Jesus. Honest investigation usually leads to a person finding the truth. And the Bible promises it. If we were to turn back a few pages to Luke 11, that would be Luke's account of where Jesus said, if you seek, you will find. Zacchaeus was seeking. He was also willing to go where Jesus was. And I think that's important. You can't just always be going where Jesus is not, if you understand what I'm saying in that. You've got to go where Jesus is. In other words, if I want to find the truth, if I'm looking for Jesus and I want to find the truth, I can't just go to every religious book and investigate it and forget the Bible. If I want to know the truth, I've got to go to where Jesus is. I can't just go to all the places that do not worship Jesus. I've got to go to where Jesus is worshiped. I've got to go to Jesus, and Zacchaeus is willing to do that. When you look at this passage, it's interesting to me how it says it, for he was to pass that way. You find out where Jesus is, and you go there. And then lastly, and all children learn the story about Zacchaeus, little Zacchaeus, climbing up in the sycamore or the mulberry or the sycamore fig or whatever your translation says, but he climbed up in that tree. And he's willing to not allow the crowd to keep him from finding Jesus. No, he does what he has to do to get, if you will, get past the crowd and find Jesus. And lastly, I'd say, notice how in this story he's always running. I mean, he's not just kind of dragging his feet to find the Lord. He's running to find him. I think that's important as well. Lastly, of course, and what really stands out to most people in the story, is that he was penitent. Regardless of what he had done, how he had gotten his wealth, or whatever else, he really has humbled himself by this time in Luke 19, and he really wants to repent. I'm going to come back to that point in just a moment as we open up the question part of it. But be thinking about the fact that Zacchaeus said to Jesus, "Half of my goods," verse 8, "I give to the poor. If I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold. I'll pay him back four times as much as I took." And there's some verses that kind of harkens back to. And then many people would say, well, no, not really. Because, you know, we look back in the Old Testament and, you know, does it or does it not? And that becomes a question. But Jesus did look up in that tree. And he did see Zacchaeus. He took notice of it. Now, I want to suggest to you, I'd like for you to turn over with me to 2 Timothy chapter 2. You can hold your hand here. We'll come right back. But I got to thinking about this verse as I was preparing this lesson, and I thought, you know, it's interesting the way Paul says this. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. "Nevertheless, the foundation of God stands sure, having this seal. The Lord knows them that are His. And let everyone that names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." Now, isn't that interesting? What Paul is saying is, God knows those that belong to Him, those that are His, those that will be His. Because some of them may still be in iniquity. They may be as Zacchaeus. But God is able to look into the heart and know the heart of the individual and know that that person, given enough time, and God has that time and forbearance for us, that person will repent, that person will leave the iniquity behind and be what they're supposed to be. It's kind of like, and it reminds me of the story of Cornelius. Now, he was a good guy, a moral guy, but he wasn't a Christian. And yet God was taking notice of him, as if to say, I know that one is mine. So now it's time. Go to him, teach him. And Peter did, and he became a Christian. The Lord knows those that are His. Well, Zacchaeus was one of those people. And it was time for him to leave his iniquity behind. Jesus took notice of him. Jesus went to his house. And as Jesus said, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. All right. Before I get to the first question that's already been turned in to me, is there anybody needs a card? Anybody especially any of you ladies, if you'd like a card, raise your hand. Wes will get a card to you. I don't see any. And so let me start by, and if you've got a question, if you're a man, you've got a question, you want to ask it or whatever, or start a discussion, please feel free to do that. But I want us to look back at verse 8, because a lot of times the question, we all look at Zacchaeus and we see this story, and a lot of it is just, you know, very straightforward, and we understand it. But the part that stands out is what he does. So let's go back and look at it, and the first question has to do with verse 8. Jesus did go to his house. The Pharisees did murmur. You know, he's going to be again. There he goes again with a guy that's a sinner. And verse 8, "Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore to him fourfold." Let me read the question as it's given to me, and it's really talking about that. And then I would be very interested to know what some of you guys have to think about it, and if you have any other questions about that. But the question says, tax collectors were noted for their dishonesty, and that is true. They're noted for being people who took advantage of their position. Jericho, for example, as I understand it, was a very rich city. They traded, exported a number of goods. Especially, there was a thriving balsam industry there. A lot of money was flowing, so a lot of taxes would be collected. And they took advantage of that. And when they went out with soldiers behind them, you know, they said, you owe so much taxes. And if they were able to collect more than they normally should be collecting, they could deposit the difference or pocket the difference, and there was a lot of corruption. So they were noted for that. And so the question asked me, was it the habit of Zacchaeus to give half of his goods to the poor? And I assume that when you're asking this question, you mean, has this been his habit in the past? In other words, just to be a very giving person. And some people point this out. I mean, is he one of these just, kind of strange, double-minded characters? You go out and you steal a lot, kind of like Robin Hood, but you give a whole lot away? I don't know. Some people actually think he may have been that kind of person. And there are those out there, of course, like that. Who was it? Was it John Dillinger? Am I thinking right? That was one of those people? I know it was one of the very famous gangsters that robbed and stole and killed and everything, and yet gave tons of money away. I think it was Dillinger. Anyway, so was it the habit of Zacchaeus to give half of his goods to the poor? Well, I don't know for sure. I have read this story, and I might be wrong, and if somebody has a different take on it, please feel free. I've always read it like he's kind of turning everything around. So no, he's not been a giving person. Now he's going to be. And it's just like, I've got all of this wealth. I've accumulated all of this wealth, maybe by less than honest means. So let me just start right from the top, and I'm going to give half of everything I've got away and just sort of cover, to start by covering what I've done by that. But then there is this whole restore fourfold if accused falsely. And was it his habit to do that? Well, I'll tell you. I don't know if it was his habit or not, but it is interesting that, and I can't remember, Cicero maybe, some Roman historian writes that it was actually Roman law that if it was proven you had taken, if you were a tax collector and it was proven you had falsely taken money, you had to pay back four times as much. The key there is proven. And it seems to be, and that's kind of like the running joke, yeah, but it never seems to be proven. I don't know about all of that. But was it his practice? Again, I take it, it has not been, that may not be right, it's just my view of it, but that he's really turning things around. And this question also asked me to explain Jesus' reply in verse 9. So let's look at verse 9. Jesus said, "This day is salvation come to this house." And I think that is because he is repenting that day, like I've been talking about, "for as much as he also is a son of Abraham." Remember, he's a Jew. And what we would liken this to is not so much a person that's never obeyed the gospel, but one who has. One who is a child of God, one who is a Christian, but has been living a sinful life. And yet, being a Christian, you have the right to come back to the Lord. You have that privilege and to be forgiven. It takes repentance. It takes asking. It takes being just like Zacchaeus is here. So I believe that's what he's saying, that Zacchaeus is actually turning things around that day. Questions? Comments? Anybody? Especially along these lines of the fourfold and so forth. All right. Or anything else you want to ask? But yet he did. Yeah. And I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I'm interested to know if you... Because, I've just lately been going back, especially with Zacchaeus, and connecting... I'm wondering, is Zacchaeus in an audience of people like in Luke 15? Whether that audience or not, but has he been following around, listening, that kind of thing? Does he know where he's going? Go ahead. Yeah. Exactly. That you don't have, right? It is interesting, but you're right. There's more to him. I mean, he's just not your run-of-the-mill guy. I mean, he's your average guy lost in this you know, this profession, etc., living this lifestyle, everything's wonderful, going fine. But yeah. Say that last part again.
I said, if you were, if you had a strategy, uh-huh, what Jesus' objective was, this was one of the people you want to have as a lift. In other words, you can lift a guy like this.
Yeah.
This brings a whole lot of credibility to your whole unbranded funeral, so to speak.
Yeah. Right. But it does show, I mean, he definitely is reaching out to all the lost. And that's his concluding point. The Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. And that includes anybody. Like a Zacchaeus, even. But you're right. It is a great... In fact, all of these like this. I mean, we could put together a list of people, not your normal... if there is such a thing. I don't know if there is such a thing as a normal convert. But... not what people normally think is your perfect candidate. And that's why I chose this whole series. This is just not your normal candidate that you would think of as a convert. Zacchaeus is just different. Anything else? Okay. Wes, I see yours. Yeah, all right, I did see your hand go up. Okay. Yeah, and you know, it's humbling, and I'll tell you, if you go back to, and I've told people this story, and I'll tell it very quickly, but if you go back to high school, remember that I said, a lot of you know this story, but you remember I said there were three of us. There were two fine, upstanding guys, you know, from good neighborhoods. They both went to church, they were good guys, and for whatever reason, they liked me. They reached out to me, and they became my friends to the chagrin of their parents. I mean, their parents were like, you know, and it's funny that, but they were, you know, I look at them in a very real sense like Jesus, willing to look further. Now, they were both teenagers, you know, but sometimes young people can have, I mean, we get down on them for the insight they cannot have, and yet sometimes they have amazing insight. Dale. Jeff, you know, that my going into their home, my studying with them is so foreign to, but you're right, you know, it's exactly the way we want to be. I mean, ideally, we want to be people that try to look deeper than just what's on the outside, what somebody's doing. I mean, one of my best friends that talked me through becoming a Christian. The first time I ever went to his house, I had a sweatshirt on with, you know, a kind of a nasty saying. And his mother was just flabbergasted. Like, what are you bringing this guy in here for? You know? We're still friends. You know? And obviously, things changed a lot over the years. But he just, to his credit, he saw something more there. And that's all I can. I mean, all I do is give the credit to them because had it not been for those people, I don't know where I'd be. You know, there just was something that they saw. I guess I don't know, but that's the way we should be. All right, Wes. I know you had your hand up, so.
Yeah, I can see both sides of the evidence, but I tend to think that he actually had a
Yeah, you know, and obviously that's not the position I take, and yet I know that that is a very real possibility. We don't know in the story. And the beauty of it is, either way you interpret it, it stands out as a great story. This is a guy, like Ed said, this is not your normal, I mean, this guy's a cut above the rest. So if he is an honest tax collector, it really makes him a cut above the rest. And regardless, if he is someone that's just, you know, taken the business and done his work and prospered and, like you said, like gained it like Abraham did, and is still looking for Jesus, then that still makes him a cut above the rest. So there are both ideas. I mean, you can find, you know, people that fall on both sides of the thing. Different reasons in the story that they will point out, you know, for one, for believing that he's one way or the other. So, you know, I don't know for sure. I mean, I have an impression of the story, and that may be totally wrong. You have an impression of the story, and that may be the right one. I don't know. But regardless, it stands out as a, you know, as a wonderful story of Jesus, of someone coming to Jesus and Jesus accepting them because of the way they came. Yeah, Chris.
So,
Yeah, definitely. And I agree. I mean, it's impressive. Sometimes, maybe, you know, to some people, it would have been more impressive. Miracles, kind of like, did I really just see that? They tend to forget. And yet, you know, Zacchaeus, and maybe this is a good point to interject this. I will tell you that if you go on and look at the history outside the Bible, which can be wrong, can be right, the traditions, if you look at it, what the traditions say is that Zacchaeus moved on to Caesarea, that he did become a Christian. He moved on to Caesarea, and he actually became preacher at Caesarea and possibly an elder at Caesarea. And there's a long-standing tradition surrounding that. You might find that interesting reading. The Eastern Orthodox Church is even, you know, somebody even has like a Zacchaeus Sunday or whatever honor, which I'm not saying we should do, but I'm just saying that there is a tradition surrounding his continued conversion. So maybe that is, you know, the, like Ed said, it's sort of 10 pages ripped out of the middle of the book. Maybe that goes on to be his story. Okay, quick questions here. Did the offer Zacchaeus made to Jesus in verse 8 to bestow half his goods to the poor and restoring anything he had taken dishonestly fourfold have its basis in the law of Moses? Any of you guys want to take a shot at that? I'll throw that to you first, and then I'll tell you what I think about it. But what parallel, if any, would apply? And this is the point. Should we take that as a principle of something we should do? And that's what this question is asking, and I think that is a viable part of this discussion. Should I, you know, how much should I give, especially if I've not been honest? How much should I restore? How much am I obligated to restore? And so forth. Anybody want to take a quick shot at that? I take that as a no. All right, go ahead, Ekon. And there are some obvious things like that you would not be able to, without question. And I believe you're right. Now, let me answer that part of it because I don't want there to be any misimpression. I don't believe this is a law. I think this is something Zacchaeus offered. But the question is it based in the law of Moses in any way? Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, when Nathan said, you know, the guy killed the one little sheep, there was a rich guy and a... And then there was a poor guy, had a pet lamb, remember? The rich guy killed the poor man, and David said he had to restore fourfold. And that may be based on an earlier law, Exodus 22, verse 1, I think the first verse of 22 or 23 there, that says you had to restore an oxen, five oxen for one oxen, or four sheep for one sheep. And I believe that that's, but again, that's not an exact parallel. So it may have, in answer to your question, may have some basis in the law of Moses, but this exact thing of if you've taken something dishonestly, you owe four times back, the answer would be no. There is also a verse, and I don't remember where it is. It's in Numbers. Somebody may remember this, but it's in Numbers, and it is also that if you, basically, if you cheated somebody and you confessed it, came forth with it before you were caught, you had to pay back maybe one-fifth was the penalty. And if that's so, it's almost like Zacchaeus is flipping it, you know, not one-fifth, but one-fourth, and do it one better, he flips it and makes it four times. That would be at least part of the law. But again, no exact parallel. Let me run through these quickly. This would be all speculation, but as a chief tax collector, does that mean that he had people working for him? The answer to that is yes. He would be in charge of all the tax collectors in that area. And they all gave back fourfold, and that would not be. This is something he is saying for himself. He is certainly not making the offer for all the people that work for him. Is it possible he didn't cheat and became rich by being honest? And as Wes said, yeah, that is very possible. The story is not necessarily saying, notice Zacchaeus says if. That's been debated, I guess, for 2,000 years, and if the world goes on, will continue to be, but not necessarily saying he cheated. In the paragraph right before that is in Luke 18, Jesus drew near to Jericho and he healed the blind man. And how are these two stories related? Well, I think Wes did a great job with that. Only in the sense that Jesus did go to that very, you know, noted city and noted for being a crime area and all of that kind of thing, and reached out to, as Wes was pointing out, a lot of the people in the society that you would tend to say, why waste your time, is what it amounts to. But he did reach out to them, and obviously with success. An observation. Zacchaeus immediately defends himself after hearing the grumblings of the people. And he does. That's right. I mean, he stood, notice in the passage, and addressed Jesus. Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. But Jesus didn't require him to prove that he's changed before going to his house, agreeing to go to his house. But Jesus was his confession to show that his household would be saved. I agree with that. It is an observation that I agree with all those points there. He does address it. Sometimes you need to address it. You know, somebody's calling you a whatever. Sometimes you need to let it go, and sometimes you need to address it. He does address it. And he makes a challenging offer here at the very least. You know, it's like, will everybody else be willing to do this as well? And most people would not. Maybe we've got time for another quick comment or question if anybody's got one, or I'll close. But can you write it down, Cleo? Do you mind doing that? Or just tell Wes and he'll tell it? Say that again. For Caesar, yeah, Roman. Yeah, you know, obviously, pure speculation. We don't know, you know. All we know is the offer he made, and the offer itself is a reflection of what's in his heart. But it is interesting to speculate on some of those kinds of things. It's interesting, but, you know, we're not going to try to draw conclusions where we can.
So the question was, because number 4 repeated a lot, and the Bible is
special. Yeah, I've never tried to get carried away. I love numbers, and I could easily get carried away with numerology. I haven't tried to get carried away with it. I guess my answer to that is I don't know. I mean, the number 4 is used a lot. I agree with you. Is there some significance, especially from God's point of view, because God tends to be the one that uses a lot of these numbers repeatedly? I don't know. I know people do make a lot out of certain numbers. Some of them, there are some obvious things about them. The cattle of 1,000 hills, I think we'd all agree 1,000 is a number of all of it, fullness. But there's some things I just don't know. So I don't know how to answer that other than by saying I don't know. Okay. Anything else quickly? If not, great discussion. Good questions. Appreciate it. And we'll close with that. All right. Next Sunday night, Wes is going to be preaching. But the following Sunday night, which will give you 2 weeks, we're going to look at Ruth. You may remember I preached on Ruth, so I'm obviously not going to say everything about Ruth. This will be the biggest passage we look at. There's 4 chapters there. I assume you know the story, but you may want to read it. But again, read it from the standpoint of why people might have thought she would be in a hopeless situation, and quite obviously she is not. So we'll look at Ruth next time. Thank you very much, guys, for the discussion, the comments. Zacchaeus, without question, Jesus recognizes him, what he's doing, and he's saved. And that's the beauty of this story. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, Jesus wants to save you as much as he wanted to save Zacchaeus. If you're willing to come to him, to confess your belief in him, call him Lord, as Zacchaeus does in this passage, be willing to repent, to change your heart, to change your life, and do what's right. The Lord will forgive you if you obey him by being baptized for your sins to be washed away. And maybe you're here and you're a child of God, and you have not been living as you should live. Be like Zacchaeus, at least the interpretation that many of us have. But regardless, be a person that is willing to come to the Lord and do what's right. Won't you please come while James leads us in the song.